right. So if you wouldn't mind, please just tell the listeners who you are, Stefan, and how you got into the business that you're currently in.
Sure. David, thanks for having me. My name is Stefan Thompson. I'm a British-born Polish South African. I run a PR company, and 4 years ago, almost to the day, I set up VisaGrad24, which is an online social media news aggregator that has become a fairly influential voice, especially as regards the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine and the Israel-Hamas war. I got into it. I set it up 4 years ago with my brother, who's my business partner. We set it up for a variety of reasons. One of those reasons was we are British born. We grew up in the UK. We moved to Poland. We feel very strongly about Poland. It's a country that our family was exiled from by the communists. That is also one of the reasons that I feel so strongly about various radicalisms, political radicalisms, and I kind of felt this urge to return, even though I was born abroad. I was raised in French schools. I was raised by a South African father. But I felt this urge to return home. And one of the things that we discovered was that there was a monopoly on the narrative outside of Poland about Poland held by the liberal left and the radical left that had access to Western outlets such as The Guardian or Le Monde or The New York Times. And they were portraying a painting of Poland that I believe was inaccurate. And that was something that we wanted to redress. That was one of the root sort of sentiments. That was one of the key reasons. And the other one was truly that the belief in promoting and defending the West and Western civilization and this idea of Roman law, Greek philosophy, and Christendom. And this West that we have built on those three hills on the capital, the Acropole, and Golgotha. And that was always the theme of it. I'm a conservative. I've always been a conservative, and it's something I was very passionate about. And we started out just focusing on Central and Eastern Europe, hence the name. And then as time grew, as time passed, and as our voice grew louder, we shifted. I mean, when the Russians invaded Ukraine, that was 2 years into Visegrad existing, it was a very natural thing to do. The full-scale invasion was terrifying from a national security perspective. There was this European peace that had only been broken by the events in the former Yugoslavia that had suddenly seen a full-scale war by a major superpower invading a European neighbor of ours. And we stepped in, and one of the things we discovered, I mean, something that we'd already known, but something that we became very active in, was combating disinformation, Russian disinformation, but also primarily today, I would say, Russian, Chinese, and Iranian disinformation. It's a powerful network. It's well-organized, well-funded, and very well-operated. And that's what we're up against, and that's sort of the mission statement that I have.
Yeah. Which part of Poland is your family from?
So my family was sort of all over, or from all over Poland. I come from an old Polish family. We come from out of Poznań, which is a city to the west of Poland, and I'm currently based in Warsaw, which is a city I deeply love. It's a city that's full of energy. And one of the most exciting things about it is, unlike Western Europe, where you have a sense that millennials and Gen Zers will be less well off than their parents and grandparents, the absolute inverse is true in Central and Eastern Europe. There is an energy, there is an economic growth that is visible to the naked eye. There is an emerging middle class. There's a deep talent pool of new technology, so software developers, engineers, coders, programmers. There's a whole startup network and hub. We've seen some unicorns emerge in Lithuania. We've seen some of them emerge in Estonia. We've seen the first Romanian unicorn recently IPO. We're seeing that in Poland as well. It's very exciting, and it's a very exciting city. It's still quite rough. There's still a lot of work to be done. Communism, 45 years of Moscow-imposed communism, have battered the country, have battered society. They've done a lot of very permanent damage on the Polish soul and on the Central and Eastern European soul. But I believe that there is a sense of optimism and hope for the future, which is something that growing up in the West, primarily London, but also other European cities, which I feel is disappearing. I feel a certain despondence from young people from my generation. I'm 30 years old, so I'm a millennial, and I see a lot of this kind of a very, very worrying and very concerning sense of of impossibilism, which is something very new for the West, I think. That I think we come from a society that, from societies, and broadly speaking as the West, is from a society that felt everything was possible, everything was achievable, everything was doable, to one of over-regulation, over-bureaucratization. And there is, I see it in many of my friends that I went to school and university with in London, where I see a certain despondence, especially in the men, and I find it very deeply concerning. And this is obviously a topic that leads us on to your area of expertise and to radicalisms. I think that the West is unfortunately becoming in many ways a festering ground for certain ideologies, precisely because of the path that it has taken for a wide range of reasons. I mean, we didn't get here because of one root cause. Also, not everyone agrees. I mean, I think a lot of people are very comfortable in the West still. There is a lot of wealth. There is a great economic wealth that has been acquired over generations. There is an old established middle class that stretches out to the Industrial Revolution. So we're talking about 10 to 20 generations of people who grew up as a middle class with something to inherit. We're talking about a vast cultural wealth. I mean, you walk around Paris, you walk around Florence, you walk around Rome, you walk around London, and many towns and villages in between. The cultural wealth is astounding. And you have an intellectual wealth that has been accumulated. And I think in many ways, I mean, this is something that many people would disagree with. I'm a Roman Catholic. I also believe there is a spiritual wealth that has been acquired over centuries of prayer and belief and faith. And I know it sounds a little bit like sort of New Agey mumbo jumbo, I'm aware of that. But I do profoundly believe that there is a great wealth that has come from this faith that has been absolutely crucial, and it's been a cornerstone of Western civilization. And I do believe that the secularization of our societies is one of the root causes of this transformation that we are seeing and what could be described as a decline of the West.
Well, you'll get no argument from me there. You're talking to somebody who was raised in the Catholic faith, and before I ended up going to university, I actually wanted to become a Jesuit monk. So I've written a few posts actually on Nietzsche's great prediction, God is dead, and what he meant by that, and that he was actually talking about what happens societally when you remove faith in God, and you basically set yourself on the path to moral relativism and sort of the postmodern world that he didn't have the language for it, but it's exactly what we've seen unfold. And he was right. But I was asking about Poland because when I went to that part of the world to cover the war in Ukraine, on my way back, I did get to spend some time in Warsaw. And strangely enough, it was right around that time that I discovered that some of my family roots, in addition to being Russian and Ukrainian and Belarusian, are also Polish. We, you know, the communists and the Nazis scattered my family to the winds. And we were also kind of a little scattered before that. So
sure.
A little bit of everything. And Poland is part of the mix for me. So I think I was in Warsaw at the time, and I love that city so much. I really regret
energy,
that
right,
I didn't
David?
Have more. Oh yeah, it was, yeah. I mean, I was working, I was compiling my notes from what I from Ukraine and putting things together, but I was just like, wow, I wish I was here just to have fun, and I so badly want to come back and spend more time here. It's
who to call when you do and you have a place to stay. It'd be lovely to have you as a guest.
Thank you. It's one of my favorite. I mean, I've been all over Europe at this point, pretty much almost everywhere, and Warsaw is right up at the top of my list. I didn't even get to see all of it, of course, but I just, it really, a lot of what you were saying resonates with me about the energy in the air and the excitement, and just it feels like a really vibrant and young city with a bright future and a deep tradition. And when you were talking also about sort of like the importance of faith, I think that is very resonant in Polish culture. And one of the things that I saw was just so many, when I was there, so many Polish people who were just opening their arms and their homes to Ukrainian refugees. And I would ask them, like, I was talking to one guy, he would drive to the border and pick people up and bring them back. And this is, you know, it was like 4 or 5 hours.
That's one example. And there were tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people doing exactly that. It was one of the greatest acts of Christian solidarity that I'd ever seen. It was extraordinary.
Yeah. 4 or 5 hours round trip. And I was like, wow. And you've done this a couple times? And he's like, no, I do this a couple times a week.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, how do you have time for anything else? And he's like, listen, this is my responsibility as a Christian, is what he said. This is just what I have to do. This is just very, very deeply instilled in me. I have to do this for these people. And as you said just now, he was far from the only person that said almost the exact same words. And I just, it just really knocked me over, just the overwhelming charity and love that they were showing to the Ukrainian people. You know, you touched on something else there about this Nietzsche's predicted path to this postmodern relativist world we find ourselves in, where something like a Russian invasion happens and suddenly it's as if everyone online, at least, is divided on what to think about this. Or October 7th takes place, and as much as you have a groundswell of support for Israel, I remember even on October 8th, before Israel had done anything that anyone could criticize, there were already people criticizing and throwing around the word genocide. And it was, which tells you just how much weight that word really has, because it's not as if they waited until the Hamas figures reached 30,000 and they said, okay, I think this is too much. Maybe I'm going to start calling this a genocide. They were calling it a genocide before Israel even responded. And yet, so the internet, it's as if we live in a time where disinformation is not only rampant, but profoundly effective. You may also recall the TikTok historians who wanted to give us a history lesson on Osama bin Laden.
Sure.
And that he was.
But there's two things, just to bounce back on that. There's two things. The first thing I wanted to sort of bounce back on was the word genocide. Interestingly coined by a Polish Jew, Rafał Lemkin. It's a very interesting word. It's actually a very recent concept. He came up with it. He based it mostly on the Armenian genocide initially. Obviously, it made a lot more sense after the Holocaust. Lemkin's a fascinating figure, someone who should be far more famous than isn't. But the way that radicals on both sides have inflated the currency of words has rendered many of them meaningless. And it's a very dangerous trend we're seeing. We're seeing it with the word racist, we're seeing it with the word fascist. We're also seeing it to a certain extent, in my opinion, with the word woke, where we are overinflating these terms, and the accusing someone of genocide is an incredibly heavy-handed thing to do. It is.
Yeah.
We live in a society where there is no accountability for words anymore, which is deeply concerning, because it also means that as we inflate the currency of certain words, we then lack the proper resources to describe events that are happening in the appropriate terms, because those terms have been rendered meaningless by people who've used them and abused them. And that is something I think we should be on our guard against in many ways. And then the second thing I wanted to bounce back on was the Osama bin Laden. TikTok is a fascinating tool. It's a tool that I've used on a personal level. I have over 100,000 followers there as myself, where I talk about history, more often than not Polish history. And there's some great stories that I've told, very friendly stories. I mean, the story of a bear that joined the ranks of the Polish army and that fought at Monte Cassino. And then I've pushed back against sort of Kanye West saying absolutely insane things about the Nazis. But the interesting thing about this, the tool, is obviously it is very obviously a Chinese CCP-controlled PSYOP, and we must push very heavily to get ByteDance to disinvest in the U.S. branch of TikTok. It is a weapon of the CCP. It's a weapon, it's a twofold weapon. It's a weapon on one hand that is a demoralizing force of the West, where we see an increasing sexualization of young girls in the West that is being pushed and rewarded by the algorithm. So we're seeing, sort of young influencer girls. I've worked with many influencers through my PR company, and I've seen this kind of downwards trends, which inevitably pushes them towards OnlyFans. It's a very demoralizing force for the West. And on the other hand, we see it in the control of narratives. The idea that the letter of bin Laden written to America to explain 9/11, the idea that 20 years later resurged in organic fashion is preposterous. It was very obviously a psyop, and it shows us the extreme strength and power that the CCP has, that they could within a week rehabilitate Osama bin Laden, the man who brought down the Twin Towers in 9/11, within a week, within the mind of a generation. Over 3,000 people were killed in New York City. And 23 years later, we are seeing young Westerners defending the man who did it, saying he had a good point. The absolute power held by Chinese disinformation, their ability to control the algorithm, inflate certain topics, and we're seeing this very clearly with the Israel-Hamas war. We can see it in the data reflected with the fact that if you analyze Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok, put them side by side and search by key terms, for example, you search for Uyghur genocide, you will find absolutely nothing on TikTok, and you will find it everywhere else. And the same is being used. It's a divide and conquer rule where the Chinese have no real stake in the Israel-Hamas war, and yet here they are clearly promoting certain narratives. And we've seen this on the Visegrad 24 TikTok, where we have something like 200,000 followers, a combined total of just under 10 million likes. But we are seeing videos. We've produced about 300 videos related to the Israel-Hamas war. And these are videos that are well-produced. These include experts ranging from MSNBC's Malcolm Nance to Deputy Mayor of Jerusalem, Fleur Hassan, all the way through to IDF soldiers, intellectuals, public intellectuals, Arab Israelis like Yosef Haddad. And these videos are not hitting 1,000 views. It is on an account that has a track record of very large numbers. So I think, you know, in terms of my very deep concerns, apart from the internal rot within the West, because it's not that the barbarians are at the gate. It's worse than that. The barbarians are in our midst, and the barbarians are not even. This is not even talking about. It's not even here. I'm not here talking about mass migration. I'm talking about the intellectual barbarians that are attacking the fundamental values and pillars and principles that have built the West into what it is. And they are within our gates. They're in our midst. They've taken over our college campuses. They've been elected to city councils. They've been elected to parliaments. They control our institutions, and they're running large swathes of the media. And it is, and we have that threat, and then the outside threat of this organized CCP, Iranian, Russian, and their acolyte, be it the Houthis in Yemen, be it Hamas in Palestine, be it other various terror groups around the world. These are well organized operations, and it is a very serious threat that is not being taken seriously enough.
Very well said. I'll just tack on one anecdote to what you said about TikTok, because I wrote about them a fairly lengthy and technical piece for the Jamestown Foundation a few years back. One of the anecdotes that came that really just shocked me was a woman who had, and this was not an isolated case, but she had downloaded the app, but then she didn't sign up. She didn't register her name. She just downloaded it and didn't touch it and figured, you know, you imagine you download Facebook and then you don't actually put in your name or have an account or anything. Mm. It's essentially a ghost app on your phone doing nothing. Except sure. in this case, the dead app was scraping her phone for data, and the data was being sent back to China.
Of course it was.
That's terrifying. And I'm not a tech person, but I was like, how is it even physically possible for it to be scraping your data when you haven't registered it? And a friend of mine was like, he's like, oh, you've downloaded it. That's all you need to do. It's like when you receive an email and you click on something in the email, it really doesn't take much to expose yourself to this vulnerability. So anybody who...
The beauty of TikTok is that it is such a great app. It is so addictive. It's digital fentanyl, and it is... The dopamine high that you get from it is beautifully designed. It's intuitive. It's easy. And it provides you with effortless virality. And the staunchest defenders of the CCP are essentially TikTok-addicted influencers living in our midst in the West defending this tool that is demoralizing us. If you look at Douyin, the TikTok equivalent in China, because obviously TikTok doesn't operate in CCP-controlled China. If you look at Douyin, Douyin serves you a very different algorithm. Every sixth video is CCP propaganda, and the algorithm promotes actual useful things, quite contrary to the West.
Yeah.
And there is a precedent for the record. Oh, yeah. There is a precedent by major powers of banning TikTok. India has done it. If India has done it, other countries should follow, and I believe that it is, there is a bipartisan bill currently in Congress, which would push for the divestment of ByteDance into TikTok, allowing for TikTok before the 2024 election, I think we will see very, very serious attempts at manipulation and fraud in that election run by the CCP using TikTok and other obviously nefarious actors.
My sister-in-law is Chinese, and I look at her app, and it's wholesome and informative, and it's great. I wish I had something like that. And then I look at TikTok, and yeah, it's like it. I mean, it's designed to poison people's minds and to trigger them into. And it's interesting how they do it. I spoke to a guy who actually wrote a 400-page report on a Russian PSYOP program that he was explaining to me that, you know, he was looking at how they were targeting certain individuals in the United States on Facebook. And they were, I was like, oh, what kind of messages were they sending them? And it was things such as maybe like a drag show that would be really offensive to a conservative and trigger the conservative to be outraged. But then they would also send something that would trigger a liberal to be outraged. So they would have like the opposite of, they would take an issue and then they would have the opposite sides of this, of the same issue, and send it to different people. And I thought momentarily, I was like, well, what would the point of that be? Because you're just driving in different directions. Don't you want to kind of push everyone in one direction? And he's like, no, you're just trying to make everybody hate each other in the country. Yeah. And then you can sit back and then let them eat each other alive. And and at the same time, sprinkle a little bit of hatred for your own government, a little post-colonial, woke progressive guilt. Hatred of the United States, guilt, right? And that's it. That's the recipe. And it works like gangbusters. It's incredibly effective. And we see that today. That's exactly what TikTok is. I believe it is a PSYOP. But going back to the point you made earlier about some of the various origins of what we see with regard to the anti-Western, anti-enlightenment, even anti-science in the United States, in some parts of the United States now, we're having a debate about whether or not it's a good thing to have algebra in school because math is racist. The extent and the depth of some of this stuff is so insidious that I think, as I believe Elon Musk has said repeatedly, you can't really rip it out at this point. It's just going to dig in deeper and be less obvious, and you can sort of pull out the obvious stuff, but like it's so embedded now. And that's true, I suppose. That's the pattern that we've seen historically with other things of this nature, is that even when they eventually lose their steam and fade, they never entirely go away. You still have remnants of them to this day. I personally came to learn, I don't know if you're familiar with my story, that you still have communists in America today walking around very fervently. Not that many of them, but they loud. Exist. Oh, yeah. And they're loud. And they do sometimes in some places have pull and get things done. And occasionally you have candidates. I mean, in Seattle, there was a socialist on the city council, Susanna Savant, who was almost recalled and she didn't run again. And now she's been replaced by a very sensible individual. But she was, you know, she was a full-blooded socialist. So to my point is that these things never entirely just get corrected and disappear. It's not really how it works, unfortunately. But I'd like to ask you, you mentioned the various different elements, there not being just one for, if you want to call this something maybe larger than woke progressivism, that might be too specialized a term, but where do you think, or what are some of the threads that you would point to as being the originators of what we're looking at today? Historical events or intellectual traditions that you would identify?
I think if I were to simplify it to its core, the West has been defeated by its own complete and utter victory. The degree of comfort that has been achieved in the West, if I were to simplify it to its core, the degrees of comfort and lack of any kind of major threat that has been felt for the last three decades are one of the causes, in my opinion, of the acceleration of these things. People need to feel a sense of purpose, they need a sense of mission, and they need a fight. And it's very difficult to find one. If you look at the history of mankind, most of our successes are achieved through some kind of struggle or fight or combat or battle. And there is a deep sense of there is a need in man, in men and women, but in man as a more general term, to have a sense of mission and purpose. And I like to think that many of the people that we've seen on this progressive left and these very woke ideologies are actually good people who are merely misguided. And that these are people that are looking for something to fight. They're looking for a way to better our societies, but they're looking in the complete wrong in a wrong place. And one of the thing is with the societies that we have built, they're obviously imperfect, but then they're nearly as perfect as could be. We have the ability to pursue capital, the ability to pursue happiness. We have uncountable freedoms. We have established foundations, legal foundations, economic foundations, political foundations. Everything has been established, and we have well-functioning and mostly well-governed societies, which makes it very hard to find a struggle or a fight that makes sense, especially when there is no immediate outside threat. This is no longer the Cold War, where we have the USSR, Russia, and its acolytes to oppose, and communists internally to fight. This is in World War II, where we have the German National Socialists. The Nazis are such an obviously bad and evil ideology. We essentially, the enemy that has been identified by these people is within. And they believe that we have, for many reasons, an imperfect structure, an imperfect society. But their solution is drastic in the sense that the only way that they believe they can better it is to tear down its very foundations. And this makes them incredibly dangerous. There's this interesting saying about tradition that goes that sort of there are certain walls that are metaphorical walls that are put in place, and these traditions shield us against monsters that we have forgotten. And this is precisely what we're seeing happening. For example, with the various waves of the feminist movement, who basically tear down at certain structures and traditions, no longer understanding where they came from, why they were established, and why they were put in place in the first place, and decide that they are inherently bad, can only be bad, must be torn down, but there are monsters that await that we no longer understand or that we have forgotten. And this is essentially, there's another lovely saying about conservatism, that it's not the worship of ashes, it's the preservation of fire. And I see these young activists, and I feel a deep, in many ways, I feel a lot of empathy for them, because I understand that they're looking, they want to have a mission, they want to have a purpose, they want to serve. And I think that is, you know, as a religious person, as a Catholic, certainly I feel that my role in society, my role as a man, is to provide for my wife and children, but it is also to serve others. So I look at them both as an enemy, in the sense that they are tearing down societies that our collective forefathers have built through great struggle, through great suffering, through great huge amounts of death, huge amount of pain. Defeating German Nazism cost 55 million lives. Defeating communism probably cost 100 million. And we've built these societies that are so beautiful. There is so much beauty in the West. There is so much to love the West for. And there is so much that I love about the West. And from its cultural heritage to its economic achievements, And to the huge amount of these transcendental ideas, good, truth, beauty, there's so much of that in the West. And I see these young people trying to tear it down, not understanding that if they do succeed in tearing it down, they will be the first victims of the destructions that they have caused. They'll be the first to go. And we've seen it time and time again in revolutions. It's the zealots that are executed first, or sent to the gulag first, or sent to the concentration camp first. Look at Hitler's brown shirts. Look at the people that surrounded Lenin and Stalin during the establishment of the USSR. And so I would simplify it to that this is a very innate desire for purpose that has become incredibly misguided, because it's very difficult to find a struggle. And because in many ways, the conservative the conservative fight or the conservative tradition that I consider myself a part of is not nearly as exciting, is it? It's not, we're not going out into the street and protesting or trashing priceless works of art with tomato sauce and slashing paintings of Lord Balfour at the University of Cambridge. We live our lives with dignity and pride, and we find purpose in the work we do, in the taxes we pay, in the children that we raise, in the very small things of life that in a cumulative way give us the West. And it's obviously it's a more exciting sales pitch. Go out, grab a Palestinian flag and run off into the street and chant Yemen, Yemen, make us proud, or from the river to the sea, and maybe graffiti some statues because you consider them old fashioned. It's more exciting than what I propose, right? Or rather the conservative tradition proposes. And that I think is one of the major problems that we have. Is that explaining the my conservative values are essentially, if they were to be simplified in one sentence, it is to sacrifice today in order to reap the benefits tomorrow. And that's a difficult sales pitch because the left, broadly speaking, simplifying, obviously I'm not saying this about every single person on the left, but the left, broadly speaking, says, live for today, carpe diem, and we'll see what happens tomorrow. And it's a polar opposite, but it's a much easier sales pitch. Taking it even to its most base level, the idea, for example, of casual sex, as we've stripped down Judeo-Christian values in the West, casual sex has become an incredibly easy and cheap commodity. There's even an economic theory around it, the idea of cheap sex, that essentially the introduction of the pill has reduced the collusion of women on the sexual market. It's introduced promiscuity. But try to explain to a young person that if you keep having casual sexual relationships, it will be more difficult to marry. It will be more difficult to be in a stable marriage. You are less likely to have children. You know, the long-term costs of that 30 minutes of pleasure are actually have very serious ramifications. But the conservative cause goes, wait, find a woman. If you're a man, find a woman you love. If you're a woman, find a man that you love, marry him, have children with him. That's a difficult sales pitch because the left is telling you, hey, go out, party, and do whatever you want. And that kind of, obviously, I'm taking it down to its most base level. I mean, it's almost Freudian in many ways. But here we are, right? That's kind of this idea of sacrifice today in order to reap the benefits tomorrow is such a difficult sales pitch, even though it profoundly makes sense and it leads to a happier life.
You nailed it, exactly. A lot of these people are individuals who you imagine when they were younger would have failed the marshmallow test. Yes. Have you seen this? Where they give children...
Of course I have.
they want what they want and they want it now, and they're not the types that are going that understand the concept of delayed gratification.
Sure.
Or investing in your future. And
sure.
But I also agree with something else you said about how I used to think that they were more cynical than I do now. And now I tend to believe actually that they are good-hearted people.
For
I've
sure.
spoken to many of them at length.
Yes.
Some of them I've interviewed, and they genuinely, the way that this brainworm
yes.
Operates is it's a parasite that feeds on the better angels of our nature, and that takes that desire to help people who are oppressed, or even who can be framed as oppressed who maybe aren't. And that's really activating. It's activating for me too when I see people who are oppressed. That's where I want to devote most of my energy, is to people who I think are in harm's way or being harmed. And so there's, all you have to do, as I commonly say, is, evil doesn't spread by telling you, hey, why don't you do some evil stuff? You'll enjoy it. It spreads by convincing you that it's actually good stuff.
That.
And that 100%. You're being good and virtuous.
And your approach of these discussions, and I deeply fear that the right, the conservative right, is adopting some of the cancel culture and beliefs that the left implemented for such a long time. Talking to each other is the way forward. Engaging these people with empathy, respect. I do think that as outlandish as some of their claims are, we must respect them and have reasonable, or try to have reasonable conversations and exchanges of ideas. If we lock ourselves, if we try and exclude some of these ideas, the people who hold these ideas from society, they'll fester. And in fact, this leads me to the other threat, the other side, which is that we are seeing obviously radicalism on the right, which I'm not oblivious to, and that I'm equally concerned about. This is happening on definitely on both sides of the aisle, and it is imperative to have these conversations and to essentially to try and bring people back to sanity. Because the price, if we don't, the price that is going to be paid, whether it is a left-wing form of extremism that takes over a right-wing form of extremism, either way, we are all bound to hell on earth. And that is not something that I wish it upon no one. I deeply fear it. And I fear that the more the left radicalizes, the more we see of just insane ideas being mainstreamed, the backlash on the right, I fear it. I'm concerned that we're seeing radicalization on the right.
In you mean in reaction to the craziness that we see on the left?
Yeah, not
as a
yes, and in reaction, of course, to decades of various policies. I mean, for example, you look at the southern border today in the U.S. I mean, I guess in many ways it's hard not to get radicalized. Several million people, I believe it's over 3 million people last year, crossed the southern border as illegals, and that migration was in many ways illegal. Migration was in many ways facilitated by the administration. So there are genuine grievances, and those grievances can be exploited. And as we talked earlier on about the way that Russian and Chinese disinformation operates, it essentially is an idea of, it's an old British idea in many ways, not even British, in many ways it's an old Roman idea of divide and conquer. It's exactly that. Mm. You push people to both sides of the political extreme, make them fight within, and at the same time, our enemies grow stronger. And our enemies truly are the CCP, Russia, and the Ayatollah-controlled Iran. And there will be. I do think that there is a radicalization on the right. We're seeing it with the mainstreaming of certain political parties in Europe. We're seeing it with a fringe part of the Republican Party that is very vocal. I don't know to what extent it's reflected in the voter base, but it certainly exists. And we're seeing that being exploited by bad faith actors, including Russia. And obviously, you know, anti-migration parties in Europe make a very valid point. Mass migration is a danger to Western societies because it is almost impossible to assimilate large numbers of newcomers in an organized and systemic way. We've seen it. The policies have failed. We've seen it in the French example. We've seen it in the British example, where both of them had very different approaches. The British, for example, ended up building council estates in wealthy areas and wealthy neighborhoods in order to try and assimilate and inspire people by providing them access to wealthy neighborhoods, but with council estates. And we've seen the failure in France with the HLM, these large cities of high-rise buildings built on the outskirts, where essentially newcomers dealt uniquely with newcomers. So you ended up having the formation of sort of Maghrebi, so Tunisian, Moroccan, Algerian enclaves outside of Paris, with a lower level of education, lower level of opportunity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But both models have ultimately failed because, and the data reflects this as well. You see, for example, in France, in the second and third generation of Muslim migrants, you actually see a greater radicalization than in the first generation. And one of the reasons is that the first generation left places like Algeria, which is a police state. It's actually a beautiful country. I've been there. Algiers is a beautiful city, La Ville Blanche, as they call it, the white city, stunning city. They leave a society that is highly militarized, that has come out of a decade civil war. They call it the Black Decade, La Décennie Noire. And they've seen the effects of radical Islam. So they come to France and they actually try and assimilate. They then fail for a variety of reasons, including the fact that there are simply too many. And then their children, who don't know Algeria, find a sense of pride both in their country of origin and in their faith. And I believe that if you were to simplify it very broadly, the idea goes thus, you're an Algerian or a Moroccan kid growing up in a bad area, a bad neighborhood of Paris, on the outskirts of Paris. You don't have economic opportunity, you cannot assimilate, and you find pride in the only thing you can. You find pride in your home country, even though you don't necessarily speak the language, and you find pride in your faith, and the idea goes, you know, simplifying it to its absolute extreme. You know, I might be poorer than the local French, I might be different looking, but at least my God is right. And that's how you get this kind of radicalism that festers. And you see it, I mean, more often times than not, many of the terror attacks that we saw, and we saw a summer of terror in 2016, I mean, it was one attack after another, many of them were perpetrated by second and third generation migrants. So, you know, but the point I was making was there is a genuine grievance and a genuine threat from mass migration, and we're seeing that migration into Europe being facilitated by the Russians, their hybrid operations have included sending tens of thousands of migrants from the Middle East and Africa to the Belarusian-Polish border, to the Lithuanian-Russian border. We've seen that happen, and I believe that there is very, very likely evidence for migration flows in the southern routes into Europe also being facilitated by the Russians, who understand that chaos and turmoil weakens the West. And there we are. So we have genuine grievances with political parties that emerge saying we would like to put an end to mass migration, introduce reasonable policy, and then in that mix of their policies, there are unfortunately other things which are less palatable and more oftentimes than not promoted by Russia, unfortunately.
You're right about the generational thing, and in fact that's true of a variety of different groups, including Chinese, by the way. Data shows that younger Chinese are more radicalized for the same reason that you explained. They face discrimination in the West, anti-Asian discrimination, and especially during COVID, in particular, anti-Chinese discrimination. And there's other factors, some of which you listed. And so they look to China, and also something that may be different from others. But they see China not only is it something they may not know and something they can have pride in, but they see China also as a rising power, as an ascendant, maybe even something that will eclipse the United States. And who doesn't want to be on the side of the future winner? So they, that's what they do, and they take that side. And a lot of you, I think there was this old notion, this idea that, you know, that people will come and people, and they might not assimilate, but their kids will assimilate. And what we're seeing actually is that in many cases, it's quite the opposite, in fact, and that their kids are the ones who end up hating America and loving our enemies. And social media is the fuel on this fire, driving it, and the fuel is being dumped by the people who control the social media, and in some cases with TikTok, that's actually China.
Another fascinating trend in France that I've seen has been conversions, or as the Muslims call them, reversions to Islam by native French from rough neighborhoods, where there is a pull and towards a religion that is perceived as strong. It is very difficult today to look at Christianity and see a religion of strength. It's certainly not the Catholic Church, and other Protestant churches are certainly not what they used to be. Whereas Islam, there is a and I say this with full responsibility. I've traveled to many Muslim countries. I have a respect for especially moderate Islam. There is a beauty in the faith of Muslims, of praying five times a day, of getting down on your knees and prostrating yourself towards Mecca in the middle of a street because it's prayer time. There is something very moving about that, and I think quite fascinating in how is it possible in the 21st century, where we've seen the secularization of our societies, that these Muslims retain that faith and pride in it and a source of strength. And obviously there's very concerning elements to radical Islam, and there's a sort of given. But that I do think there is almost something inspiring in the faith of Muslims and its unshakability in many ways. And, you know, I mean, putting it even in a kind of almost in a primal way, were you to take a T-shirt and with, you know, with blasphemy against Jesus Christ, and the Jewish God, and you were to wear it on a T-shirt and walk through London or Berlin or Paris, nothing would happen to you. Were you to insult the Prophet Muhammad, I mean, I'm obviously not condoning violence, but we both know that and anyone who's listening is fully aware that were you to walk through a majority Muslim neighborhood of Paris, of Berlin, of London, with a T-shirt like that, you would likely be beaten up, if not killed. And there is a lesson, there is some lesson in that. Obviously, I don't believe the lesson is, for the record, I don't believe the lesson is that one should use acts of violence to defend one's faith. But there is something quite fascinating and interesting in the fact that Muslims will defend their faith in such an ardent way, something that we've given up in the West.
They have pride. It goes too far. It goes to a violent extreme, and that's reprehensible.
Sure.
But they have profound pride in their faith, whereas I think it's easier to bring out of Christians, to bring out of, let's just say, the West in general, although that's sloppy, but to bring shame out of them,
yes,
and embarrassment out of them for who they are and what they believe, and to talk to them about the mistakes that Christians have made in the past and to make them hang their heads low. You can't talk to Muslims about the mistakes they've made in the past, and they have. How about the slave trade that they were running, for instance? But you can't shame them with that information and make them feel embarrassed to be Muslim. It just doesn't work. They know their history. They have pride in who they are, and that is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
The extent to which it goes sometimes, I think it doesn't even need to be said. That is horrible. But I agree with you that it not only is it beautiful, but I think that Christians would be much better off if they felt something like that, some pride in who, and not being able to be so easily shamed. And the same thing applies not just with regard to religion, but also with regard to, let's say, to race, where you now have in the United States, for instance, you know, so many well-meaning, good-hearted, liberal white folk who just feel terrible that they belong to an evil race.
Yeah.
Because they happen to, because, you know, white people have done atrocious things in the past, and so now they have to hang their heads low. And you even have, I forgot the name of the group, but there's even these women that go around now lunching with people for obscene sums of money in order to simply tell them to their face, well, you're racist, and make them cry.
I've
and they pay
them.
Money.
Yeah, you are. Better. The name escapes me as well.
I mean,
yeah.
And similar to the case with Muslims, I see something of that kind of beauty in the Black community, because
Absolutely.
For whatever flaws you might want to talk about, the high crime rates or whatever that you might want to say, there's a pride there where you're not going to make Black people feel ashamed of their Blackness. It's not going to happen. They're proud, and it's beautiful to see a people proud of of their community. That's a good thing.
Absolutely. Though obviously, to me, the racial aspect is not necessarily important. It's more and in fact, generally speaking, whites are, I can't remember the exact studies, but there is, in my opinion, I have seen data that reflected that there was kind of, in terms of in racial pride, it was the lowest felt amongst the whites, generally speaking. But it is interesting that the West, the collective successes of the West, I mean, it was, I feel no guilt for the slave trade. I wasn't a part of it. My forefathers, I mean, I'm half Polish. The Poles are Slavs. The word slave obviously derives from my
exactly.
people. I don't, and it was ultimately William Wilberforce was very much a white man, and the abolishment of slavery, which is a great pinnacle of human civilization and of achievement and of enlightened values, was achieved and enforced at great cost by white countries at the time, of course.
Yeah.
But it is the permanent. I do also think that the left is correct in holding itself, of holding our civilization accountable. I do believe in accountability and responsibility. That's not something that I think is a bad thing. It's just if you merely focus on the bad things that your forefathers, and this is the other thing, is that ultimately these are not our crimes. I mean, this becomes obviously an ethical question. Are you the, if we are the heirs, if the successors of our fathers have been bequeathed to us, have their failures and sins also been passed down to us? Obviously we take pride in the achievements. I take great pride in the achievements of Western civilization, of my people, more specifically the Poles, of the contributions that they have made to the West. And I obviously also feel shame at some of their failures and shortcomings and sins and mistakes. But self-flagellation and focus uniquely on one aspect and just on the negatives, when also there's negative, especially in the case of slavery, I mean, which is a particularly silly one. Slavery was an abominable thing, but it was most certainly not practiced uniquely by white people. And it is practiced to this day across large swathes of, swathes of Africa, where there are open-air slave markets to this day that exist. Countries like Mali, I believe Mali has a sizable percentage, I believe 2-4% of Mali are slaves to this day. And even to a certain extent in the Middle East, where you have a form of indentured servitude, where the migrant workers that are being brought in from the Philippines, from India, and many other Central Asian countries, with their passports taken away, being given an absolute pittance, made to work, essentially work like slaves, that is a form of slavery, practiced to this day. And I don't see any of the white liberals who complain about the evils of slavery, which was abolished in the 19th century and eradicated across the West, I don't see them complaining about the slaves and most certainly there are, in my opinion, not just indentured servants in Dubai, but there are most likely just genuine slaves. I don't see the protests against that.
I think this is because although they, again, as we said before, their intentions are correct, but there are people, there are academics and intellectuals maybe who might be more of the cynical type who are pulling the strings here. And I think that all of these different attacks and interpretations that we're seeing, they all lead back to anti-US sentiment or anti-Western sentiment. And that's why you sort of brush away the great things, the great accomplishments and achievements done, or you try to critique them and infect them with, you know, math is a good thing. No, math is racist. The science is a good thing. No, that's a Western accomplishment of development, and therefore we have to sort of interrogate and critique it until it's dismissed as the easiest and most readily available dismissal is usually racism, but anything else really will do. And it's all of these things trace back, unfortunately, to, I think, anti-West and the U.S. being the prime sort of representative poster child of that. And I think that's actually what a lot of what we're seeing in Israel right now comes down to. Israel is seen as the little brother of the U.S. The U.S. is the imperial overlord, evil demon power. And therefore, Hamas, regardless of whatever they may have done on October 7th, they're anti-U.S. in a sense, and that therefore means they're the good guys.
Yes.
And it's really as simple as that. That's it. So I'm pro-China. I'm pro-Russia.
Yeah.
That's as far as it goes for a lot of these people.
Although I think in the case of the Israel-Hamas war, there is also an element of the Westerners have a kind-hearted tendency of siding with what they perceive as the underdog. And Hamas is very much perceived as the underdog. You know, ignoring the complete geopolitical reality on the ground, ignoring the fact that there are 23 Arab states and most of them are absolutely inimical to Israel and to the existence of Israel, ignoring the fact that there's 150, if not more, 150,000 displaced Israelis who have been moved from the north where there's shelling by Hezbollah, who's a regular army. Hamas, obviously, is also, in many ways, it might not have tanks and fighter jets, but it is a regular organized army of some 40,000 individuals, which is which has most of all wreaked havoc upon the Palestinian population and the civilian population. But there is a kind of, they're perceived as the underdog, and the West tends to side with the underdog, that sort of David, biblical David and Goliath story. But with Israel as well, the other thing is the Jewish people, the Jewish diaspora has been an incredibly successful minority pretty much wherever they have gone across all major fields. And there is a resentment to their success. Instead of, and this is something when I look at the Jewish diaspora as a poll, I look to the polls have a large diaspora. We've got a diaspora of about some 20 million people who claim Polish heritage. I look at the Jews and I think, how can we emulate their successes abroad? How can we replicate that? I don't look at it with, oh, you've overachieved, therefore you must have somehow gamed the system, tricked people, cheated people. No, I look at it with a positive envy. How can I replicate? What can I learn from these people? And I do think there is a lot of, we live in an era of great resentment where a lot of people essentially like to blame their failures instead of their own work ethic or their own shortcomings. They want to blame their failures on the successes of other people. That somehow, you know, this sort of silly understanding of the world as a zero-sum game, which it is not.
Right.
And sort of believing that because someone else has outperformed, that means that has somehow cost them. I do think there is a... I also think that the same way, I do think there is a kind of some element of underlying anti-Semitism. I also think that many of the protesters we've seen across the West, and we've seen huge protests which have been deeply upsetting, that the people protesting, especially in a place like London on the 11th of November, on Remembrance Sunday, marching not to remember the men who gave them the freedom to go out onto the street and march, but to go and march about a country they've never been to, about a war that they know very little about, that is several thousand kilometers away. They'll march out with Palestinian flags and shout slogans on the day that is meant to commemorate the people who fell and died and bled for the country that has given them asylum, that has given them a home, that has given them opportunities. And to spit on that heritage is absolutely shameful. But I do also think that many of the people involved are simply misguided. It isn't a, especially the liberals who attend those marches. I do think it might not be an innate sort of anti-Semitism, but rather just a very shallow understanding of the conflict and of the situation on the ground. There's a very amusing video where Yosef Haddad, who is a Christian Arab Israeli, went to a university campus and met a student who was trying to enlist people into an organization that was anti-Israeli and that referred to Israel as an apartheid state. And Yosef asks this young person, he goes, could you define apartheid for me? And obviously, this person responds with a sort of inane response of, I haven't really looked into it. I can't exactly define it. Maybe you could Google it. is that person
what?
Is that person sitting at that desk trying to enlist people into the Palestinian cause? Is that person an anti-Semite? No, I would argue that is a very, very misguided person that has been led to believe things.
Yeah, that's a major problem I find with you know, from the river to the sea. I would argue is a genocidal phrase, sure. But in the mouths of most of the people that are chanting it, it isn't, in fact, because all you have to do is ask them, well, what river and what sea?
Absolutely.
And they don't even know what they're saying. So.
Absolutely.
Or genocide. I had this conversation recently. Someone said, how can you support they heard that I was pro-Israel, and they're like, how can you support the genocide? And I was like, well, can you define genocide for me, please, before we have this conversation? And they essentially gave me a definition that meant killing lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, then
that's
in that case,
yeah.
I mean, that's not what it is. But if we're going to define it as just killing lots of people, then sure. But maybe we can kind of pull apart the problems with that definition and have that conversation instead. And that's what we ended up doing. But this is a much larger problem. And maybe it's something that's always been around and we just never knew about it until social media allowed us to have more easy access to other people's thoughts. But what I find often, something that I've listened to other people talk about in the past, Sam Harris is one who has often commented on people grossly distorting things that he said very clearly and very plainly. And then they'll just like cut off like one half of the sentence to make it sound like he said he supports slavery or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got wrapped up in a controversy of my own with regard to an argument I made about the psychologies of Hitler compared to the psychology of Lenin, both of whom are detestable, evil men. And people were like, "Oh, so that means you love Hitler." And then later I made a comment just recently about how I love India. I lived in India for years. It's one of the most beautiful countries that I hold closest.
Fascinating.
Heart. Yeah. And people are like, "Oh, how could you attack India so brazenly?" And I said, "No, I'm saying that I love it and I hope that it improves because it's one of my favorite places in the world. I want to take my daughter there one day, but I don't know if I would let my daughter go on her own the way that it is right now." There is a serious problem there with sexual violence. And people are like, "Oh, how can you crap on India like that?" And as you said earlier in our conversation about you commented on the importance of civil discourse. And I'm a former university lecturer of logic and debate. I used to have debate, like formal debates and informal debates in my classrooms and teach students. What do you do when someone is being incredibly rude or just using ad hominem, maybe just calling you stupid and distorting your language? And I like to think that I'm fairly cool-headed in these situations and that I handle these things with dignity and fairness. But I'm not losing my cool when these things happen, but it is exhausting. It is exhausting to have people, and you reach a point you realize. When the Hitler Lenin thing happened, and I was turning to a friend and saying, "I've explained myself multiple times. I've said, for instance, that Hitler is an evil man, and it is a wonderful thing that he was killed. It's only too bad that he wasn't killed more slowly." You know, like, I'm trying to make myself as clear as possible, and he's like, "David, they're not misunderstanding you. That's your problem. They're pretending to misunderstand you so that they can mount these arguments. It's not as if you're failing to effectively communicate here." And they know what you're saying. They don't care, and they're going to leverage your words to make the point. If they were to listen and understand, they would no longer be able to make the point.
There is a wonderful saying that never attribute to malice what can be attributed to incompetence. Which I also think obviously I think there's many, many bad faith actors. I also think but I also do think that many, many people are simply misguided people are busy with life. And to most people, Israel Hamas war, it's a long way away. They read something, they read a tidbit here, a social media post there. They saw a few of their favorite influencers post a Palestinian flag and they get on the train. Yeah. And in that sense, I think there is a distinction to be made where there are radicals that we cannot converse with because that is a waste of time, of energy, and in many ways that is their strategy. That the exhaustion of, I mean, that's also part of the disinformation strategy, right? Yes. Flooding the internet with bot comments, many of which make no sense. There is an exhaustion to it, and I see it with. I stopped reading comments on. It's been a while since I have a team that posts, but I used to read the comments and I used to try and engage with people, and especially when it was much smaller and more manageable, and I found it enjoyable, and I did see this pattern of bot comments basically just trying to destroy the discourse. And being that bad faith actor that's making it impossible to have a reasonable and sensible conversation, and just sort of fanning the flames. But that sort of needs to be disregarded. One cannot end up just disregarding. It is so important to have these conversations, and
when you're having conversations, there's an audience of people, many of whom are fair-minded. And so you might be talking to someone who you will never get through to because they're playing a game with you, and they know full well, in my case, for instance, they know that I didn't say these absurd and disgusting remarks that I never said that they're accusing me of. They know that, and they're just not being honest. But there are people listening on the wings, And for their sake, I think it's worth engaging sometimes, because you get to maybe get through to those people and to have an indirect conversation or engagement with people who are listening. I think that makes it worthwhile for me, even when I'm feeling exhausted that I'm going into round four with somebody who isn't understanding the basic sentences that I'm putting in front of them. That makes it worth it for me to continue going.
Yeah. No, and I do think that one cannot let oneself be worn down. And I've seen this, I saw this on the right. I was involved in the conservative right in Europe, and I saw some of the people that I worked with over the years. I don't necessarily want to give names, but people who, the cancel culture, the hit pieces, and the lack of discussions with them, they were people who held reasonable views a decade ago, who today I find myself on the polar opposite spectrum with, because no one reached out from the left, no one reached out from the center, and they were marginalized, they were demonized, they were called racist, xenophobic, anti-Semitic, many of these things which they were not. And that lack of conversation actually radicalized them. They would read a hit piece in The Guardian about themselves, or they would see the ADL attack them and call them all sorts of things that they were clearly not. And that led to their radicalization. And I think if we demonize, and again, they've ended up holding some pretty reprehensible views, many of these people. These are people that I no longer am on speaking terms with. The conversations make no sense, especially around the major break point for me was the stance of many of these people on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, where I saw people who I'd invited to Poland, to whom I explained the Polish history, to whom I explained the two of my grandfather's brothers were murdered by the NKVD in the mass graves of Katyn and Starobielsk in 1940. I explained the nature of Russian disinformation to, suddenly explaining to me, oh, Ukraine is a corrupt place, it's a corrupt country, and it's not really a state, and they don't deserve a country, they don't deserve their independence. And why are they wasting men's lives in Lugansk, Donbass, and Crimea? And Russia really owns these places, and Ukraine is Russia anyway. And that was the kind of the breaking point. But the rabbit hole that led them there definitely involved demonization by mainstream media, left-wing outlets running virulent and violent hit pieces against them and calling them names that they were not. And I believe that the lesson to be drawn from that is that if the center and center, the center right and conservatives, common sense conservatives, push too hard against people who are woke, demonize them, exclude them from society, we will only further radicalize them. And this is kind of the essence of the conversations that you have about radicalism. This is where we're at, and we have to be conscious of the danger on both ends. One of the people I recently had a really wonderful discussion and conversation with was Brianna Wu, who at one point in time, she was one of the main people behind Gamergate. At one point in time, she could have been described as more left-wing than Antifa. Brianna and I had a wonderful conversation, very interesting one, an in-depth conversation, and we found a lot of common ground. And obviously the conversation was in good faith. And one of the reasons that we connected was she had a very interesting stance on Israel, very unexpected from the radical left. And she still holds many views that are obviously not mine. I mean, we have differences of opinion. But we were able to have a very civil and respectful conversation, which I was very grateful for, and I genuinely enjoyed. And I think that's kind of that's sort of the lesson, that we must be wary of these the sleep of reason awakens monsters. This is kind of, and unfortunately, we are in a period of time that is marked by insanity, and it's marked by insanity on both sides. But I am quite concerned about what is coming. I do think that things will have to get a lot worse in order for them to get better. And one of the ideas behind that is simply that radicalism, be it on the right or on the left, that it is a destructive force, and evil doesn't build anything. All it can do is tear down existing structures and leave ashes behind. And I deeply fear that we may reach a point where much of what has been built painstakingly at great cost over 2,000 years is left in ashes. Mm-hmm. I really do. I genuinely fear that. I obviously think there is a great strength in Europe. There is a great strength, and there is hope in that strength. But I also see a great deal of cowardice, even around the Israel topic. How many non-Jewish conservative voices have stood up and spoken up and done so with moral clarity? Not many. How many Western conservatives have stood up and condemned and pushed back on the Russian invasion of Ukraine? Not as many as one would hope. And this is this kind of epidemic of cowardice where we see transgender or transsexual library readings for primary school students. Why is it that more parents do not stand up and say, this is not right? Why are these transsexuals wanting to read to our children in the first place? The question that arises is aside from where has the insanity come from, is where is the courage and moral clarity of the silent majority? And why are so many men cowered into silence? And I do think it's mostly men. I do believe in this case that it is absentee fathers, a lack of presence and lack of strong father figures that is to be blamed for this. Where are these fathers? Why are they not standing up? Why are they allowing transsexuals to come in to primary schools and read to their children? And it's not even an issue of whether one thinks transsexuals are right or wrong or whatever it is. It's just a matter of principle of why on earth does a grown-up man dressed as a woman want to read to primary school children? This is a fundamental question. Right there. And there is no rational answer.
I mean, it gets much uglier than that. I mean, if you've watched some of the videos, you know, I've seen where during the readings, there's been some where it's like, okay, this looks fine. Nothing, just reading a story here, doing a performance. Okay. And then you have the ones where they're bringing children up to answer questions while holding the microphone at their crotch as if it's their genitals and having the kids speak really closely into the microphone. I'm like, what? Are there no other adults in the room seeing this happen, absolutely, running over and ripping the microphone away? Well, what is happening here? And that's just one example. There's many others I've seen. I mean, do a Google search and you'll find more than you care to look at. And you're right. Like, where the voice, where, I mean, there are people speaking, there are obviously parents are getting angry, but
of course
this is all very depressing. Where do you see I do agree with you that things are probably going to have to get better before they get worse.
They have to get worse before they get better, you mean?
Sorry, they're gonna have to get much worse before they get better. Do you consider yourself an optimist nevertheless?
I like I said, I'm a Roman Catholic. I have to be an optimist. Pessimism and defeatism are not the traits or characteristics of a Christian. I know that this is a deeply religious answer, and I'm probably not what you want to hear. But my hope...
No, please.
Ultimately, man's purpose, in my opinion, or rather in the belief, in my belief, man's purpose is to find salvation. And salvation is not of this world. I know it's a very religious answer. That is, in that sense, I am deeply optimistic. I do believe that the forces of evil can be defeated. I do believe that there is a great spiritual battle that is being fought. I believe that profoundly. I think we're dealing with very evil forces here. But I do think that there is a joy. As a Polish World War II hero, Witold Pilecki, he was the only known man to have volunteered to go to Auschwitz, spent 3 years in the camp, documented it, built a resistance network in the camp, escaped, wrote a report. It was sent to the Allies, ignored, unfortunately. It was sent to the Polish government in exile in London, presented to the British authorities. He informed the world about the Holocaust. He then fought with distinction in the Warsaw Uprising, then went to the West, returned to Poland to fight against communism, even though he was already on lists and the communist authorities were aware of his existence, brutally tortured and executed in a show trial. He was a man of great faith who carried a copy of The Imitations of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis. And in his prison cell, one of the final things he wrote was that I have found a joy in my willingness to fight. And I think there is something incredibly beautiful and incredibly simple in what he said. And his fate was tragic. This man, his body has not been found. He was dumped, like many other anti-communist Polish fighters, his body was desecrated and then dumped in an unmarked grave. We're still looking for it. Eventually, we will find him, exhume him, and give him proper burial. But 60 years after his death, he's become a World War II hero. He's become a hero again. His story was uncovered. His story has been told. And it turned out that the communists, who believed that if they murdered these World War II heroes, if they destroyed these anti-communist fighters, if they buried them, they would bury the truth as well with it. And it turned out that their bodies were not as though they were dumped in the dumpster of history. Their bodies turned out to be seeds, and there's a great deal of pride and strength has been born out of this man's sacrifice, and the sacrifice of many other Polish anti-German Nazi and anti-communist fighters. And that is my hope, that I cannot change the world. I can only change my own sort of stance towards what is happening. And I think that Witold Pilecki has phrased it correctly. And I find a great joy and optimism in the willingness to stand up for what is right, to the best of my ability.
The joy and the willingness to fight, that is a phrase that I am going to remember.
Okay. And whenever you're in Europe, please reach out. It would be a joy to meet. It would be an absolute joy to host you in Poland. I would love that.
And that would be amazing.
Thank you. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.